Hello and welcome to the Spectator podcast. I'm Laura Prendergast, and on this week's episode, we'll be asking how Theresa May might save the Union. We'll also be diving deep into Paradise Lost, and then we'll be singing the praise of endangered Cypriot songbirds. First up, May's battles. The Prime Minister's now fighting a war on two fronts, and there's no room for mistakes, says James Forsyth in this week's cover piece. He joins me now along with Alex Massey, our Scotland editor. So James, you detail these two thankless tasks that May now has in front of her. How is she going to cope with both of them?
She now has this challenge, which is she needs to successfully negotiate Britain's exit from the European Union and preserve the Union here at home. If she achieves this, she's going to join the pantheon of great prime ministers. But if she fails, she's going to be keeping Lord North company in the history books. And I think what makes this such a difficult challenge is that the EU negotiations are undoubtedly complicated by the SNP's desire to hold a second independence referendum. So she's got to kind of somehow find a way to do these two things. And I think, you know, as we talked today, as they U-turn on their budget, you know, they can't make any mistakes. There is no margin for error for her here, because the Nats start off in Scotland at, you know, 45%. They only need one in 40 voters to change their mind to win this thing. And I think that is the real challenge for her.
And Alex, from your position up in Scotland, how do you think May's prospects are looking?
James is quite correct that this is the defining test now for the Prime Minister, just as, of course, it was for her predecessor. You know, David Cameron breezily announced that he would be, you know, his record would be determined by saving the Union at home and winning a referendum on Brexit and securing Britain's membership of the European Union. Well, we've seen how that turned out for him, and there's obviously a risk for Theresa May that something similar could happen to her. The referendum is a difficult one for almost everybody concerned, however. Nobody would really want to be starting from here. I think Nicola Sturgeon is absolutely right when she says this isn't her preferred beginning to the process. But as soon as Scotland voted differently from the rest of the United Kingdom last year, and she said that a referendum now had to be on the table, and then it subsequently was deemed, you know, highly likely, even more likely, all but impossible to avoid. After a while, that sort of builds up a degree of momentum, and you have to go for it, even if it is a high-risk gamble, because we see that there isn't any great enthusiasm for another poll in Scotland. A large number of people are actually dead set against it. A good number of people who think it's somehow sort of cheating, offending a sense of fair play to have another referendum so soon after the first referendum, which was only in 2014, after all. And this, plus, of course, the uncertainties of post-Brexit life are such that anyone who makes any strong predictions, I think, as to what's going to happen is guilty of misleading their readers, their viewers, their listeners.
I think I think what Alex said about the lack of enthusiasm for second referendum is fascinating and crucial to Number 10's strategy. Their aim is to win this referendum by not fighting it. They think that they can demand that Nicola Sturgeon gets a mandate in a fresh set of elections to Holyrood for a referendum, and that she would not get that mandate. But if there was a Scottish Parliament election with the issue of a second referendum at the centre of it, the SNP and the Greens combined would not have a majority and therefore would not be able to hold a referendum. I'm told that they are testing this in focus groups, and the results that are coming back are emboldening them. They are becoming more confident in this strategy. And so I think we will, in the end, see not a straight no from the UK government to a second referendum, but a demand that Nicola Sturgeon goes out and gets a direct, clear mandate from the Scottish voters in a Holyrood election for it.
I think that's obviously a high-risk strategy. I think it's much easier to say, yes, we're opposed to there being another referendum until such time as an actual Brexit deal has been concluded, and that would, at least in theory, thereby allow a referendum perhaps in the autumn of 2019. I think it's quite easy to say that, no, it would be foolish and unfair on Scottish voters to be asked to make a choice of this sort before they had the opportunity to appraise the various options available to them, i.e. therefore that there must be a Brexit deal as one of the alternatives to be considered. I think that, you know, it's easy to say that there shouldn't be a referendum in 2018. I think punting it beyond 2021 is extremely difficult, because you then make that a single issue Holyrood campaign, and that's even if you accept the fact that the SNP don't have a mandate at present, and that's a very dubious proposition, since the SNP manifesto in last year's Holyrood elections explicitly outlined the very scenario that we now find ourselves in, of Scotland voting differently from the rest of the UK, but the UK voting to leave the EU, and said that that would be the sort of material change in circumstance without which another referendum would be impossible or unjustifiable. So the question then becomes is, would there be in the longer term a backlash against the UK government if it was seen to be frustrating the will of the Scottish people? Because that will, of course, can change. And at the moment, because the UK government hasn't taken a decision on this, there isn't, if you like, sort of an opposition to its proposals thus far. But as soon as it has proposals, there then creates an opportunity for there to be opposition to that. And they are obviously not wanting to get into the situation where they start acting in the way that Madrid has acted with regard to the Catalan question in Spain. And of course, you know, the Scottish Conservatives themselves have conceded that there's no real right to block a referendum, quote, forever, unquote. So this would be a high-risk strategy from the Prime Minister and the UK government. I don't say it couldn't work, but it would be one that you wouldn't want to embark upon without giving it serious consideration.
As one of those involved said to me, when I put this point to him, he said it's high risk, but it's less high risk than holding a second independence referendum. And I think that is, you know, there are no low-risk options here. I think that's one of the...
And James, what does this all mean for the EU negotiations, the prospect of having a Scottish referendum?
I think it means two things. First of all, whatever deal is negotiated will have to be defendable in the Scottish referendum. I think that makes walking away and trading with the EU on WTO terms, you know, even less appealing than it was before. And I think the second thing it means is it undoubtedly gives the EU negotiating leverage. I can imagine a scenario in which the EU say, oh, well, if you don't want to pay this divorce bill that we think you should pay, maybe we'll say something nice about how Scotland could join the single market straight away. You know, there are definitely ways it gives them ability to apply pressure to the UK government. But I think there is a weird paradox of this whole situation in two ways. One is the fact the UK is leaving the single market, I think, complicates the case for independence considerably and weakens it too. I think if you could say, oh, both Scotland and Rump UK will be in the EU, therefore they're not going to be any customs checks, they're not going to be any tariffs, and there's obviously going to be continued free movement. I think it is very hard to make that case given that Britain is leaving the single market. Just look at what's going to happen to the Irish border. I think there is one other element here as well, which is this, which is if these Brexit talks turn nasty, as they may well do, I think that is a double-edged sword again for the nationalists, because I think some voters in Scotland will think, hang on a second, if dissolving a 40-year-old diplomatic union that doesn't involve a shared national debt, a shared social security system, a shared military, gets this ugly, imagine what dissolving a 300-year-old nation-state union is going to be like.
Absolutely, I agree with all of that. And again, it's a reminder that although the political argument for independence has been strengthened by Brexit, the practical aspects of independence are vastly more difficult and complicated as a result of Brexit. And so, you know, this is a high-risk manoeuvre from the SNP as well. You know, the risk is not all on one side by any stretch of the imagination. And James is absolutely right about many of these points. You know, the Irish example is going to be extremely significant. The smoother, more frictionless border there is between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland, the more that will be seen as setting a precedent for an Anglo-Scottish frontier in the event of Scottish independence. So in terms of, you know, customs posts and a hard border, you know, from a unionist perspective, the more difficult or the worse things are in Northern Ireland, the better they are in Scotland and vice versa. And that too is, I think, a fairly unappetizing bargain for the Prime Minister have to try to strike or to come to terms with. But, you know, the difficulties are such that, you know, you already now have the suggestion, it was floated in the Times a few weeks ago, that, you know, perhaps if Scotland voted for independence, the SNP wouldn't immediately seek to join the European Union. They would instead seek something of a Norway-style relationship, joining the European Free Trade Area, and that would allow them access or membership of the single market, but also allow for a deal between an independent Scotland and the rest of the UK, a UK market that is, after all, worth four times as much to Scottish business as the EU market is. And that relationship between Edinburgh and London in the aftermath of independence would be extremely important and extremely difficult to negotiate, I think. And in that sense, too, the Brexit negotiations are going to be a warning, I think, of the difficulties that lie ahead, and a further reminder that there is the potential for this to end very badly for almost everybody concerned.
That was James Forsyth and Alex Massey. On to our next item, Paradise Lost. In this week's issue, Boyd Tonkin says that it still speaks to readers on its 350th anniversary. He joins me now, along with Sam Leith, our literary editor. So, Boyd, why does Milton still matter?
Well, he matters because, after Shakespeare, I think he is the greatest English poet, because he was involved in his time, in the politics, in the power of his time, in a way that is virtually unique among great English poets, and because he is grappling with questions of good and evil, of freedom, of power and responsibility, of love and of faith, which are absolutely the deathless material of poetry.
That thing of him being involved in his time, I think, is interesting to say, because, I mean, Shakespeare obviously was very much, yes, but we often think of poets as sort of in some way standing outside the hurly-burly.
Well, I think it's fair to say that, OK, Chaucer was also a court official, but Milton held a role after the execution of Charles I in 1649, which is probably unique in the annals of English literature. He was what was called the Secretary for Foreign Tongues of the Commonwealth and the Protectorate, which basically means that he was an intellectual spin doctor. And his spin doctor role meant that he had to go out and argue with all the writers, diplomats, theologians around Europe, who were basically saying that the English had gone completely stark raving bonkers, by not just by killing their king, because kings were killed all over medieval and early modern Europe, but by killing their king by the process of a formal trial. In other words, by doing this to them, what was an absurdity of trying the king for treason.
It was a category error for them.
It was intellectually inconceivable.
I mean, it's in a period of political upheaval at the moment as well. Do you think Milton can still offer some guidance?
Well, what I'm trying to say, and I think quite sincerely, is that whatever side you're on in another time of very deep divisions, he can speak to you. He wrote Paradise Lost in the late 1650s and 1660s, when essentially for someone of his revolutionary and republican opinions, everything was going wrong. The Cromwell regime was collapsing, then Charles II came back. So what to him was this brief, glorious interlude of free government in England had been snatched away, and we were back with the reactionary old guard. So if you like, he was turning his despair, his dismay, into something that, as he puts it in Paradise Lost, he sought to justify the ways of God to men. In other words, to try and make it make sense to him and his contemporaries.
One of the questions that might, to me at least, arises slightly is that, you know, we see Milton as this sort of revolutionary enemy of the sort of despotic power of kings. Yes, yeah. But of course, in one reading of it, you know, God is a sort of despot in the thing. And, you know, the revolutionary is Satan. Yes, and, of course, there's the argument always about Milton that, you know, he was of the devil's part without knowing it. Yeah. I mean, how much do you see that as being a plausible argument?
The fantastic thing about Paradise Lost is that it does contain these many possible interpretations. And Satan in particular, he goes from being kind of hero to villain and back again, almost line by line. So it's perfectly true that at some points he appears the great heroic revolutionary. But then, this again is amazingly prescient and prophetic, he appears like the revolutionary who turns into a dictator. He becomes the tyrant in his own right. And therefore we see that the potential bad outcome of this kind of rebellion.
Well, I think I'm just remembering that the only parliament in Paradise Lost is the Pandemonium, isn't it?
It is. It's the Parliament of Devils. And Milton himself, although he did serve the revolutionary regime in the 1650s, he was essentially he was opposed to tyranny, whoever the tyrant had to be. And for him, that tyrant could be a parliamentary majority just as easily as it could be a single despotic ruler.
As well as Satan, you also mention Eve as a new, as a more striking character for modern readers. Why is that?
Eve is... Satan is, I think, one of the great characters of English literature, and so is Eve. Adam in Paradise Lost is slightly drippy. He's first of all, he's very obedient. Then he does what he shouldn't have done and eats the fruit at Eve's bidding. Then he's terribly guilty, and then he's repenting and remorseful. But Eve is much more complex, much more interesting, much more... I think she's much brighter than Adam, basically. So she questions everything. And, of course, for Milton's theology, although this leads in the first instance to the disaster of the fall and the expulsion from paradise, of course, the fall had to happen for mankind to be redeemed by the sun, and therefore Eve is the absolute linchpin of the entire story. And she argues incredibly astutely. One of her reasons given to herself for eating the fruit in the first place is because Adam and God have been going on about how she is of an inferior status. She's the secondary creation. So she says, well, if I eat this fruit, which carries this amazing knowledge and this amazing access to wisdom and understanding, that'll make me equal. She says, for inferior, who is free? And the logic is absolutely impeccable. She wants an equal relationship with Adam. And the serpent offers her a kind of designer drug that will allow her to get there in one bite.
Attractive.
Yes. One of the biggest issues we have at the moment is free speech, and yes, Milton gave us Areopagitica, which is the great kind of original defence of free speech.
Now, I think that it would take some editing, but I really think that Areopagitica should be taught in every secondary school in the country. You could fillet it and choose highlights, but it is just as relevant as it was in 1644. And it's interesting to remember that he wrote it not against the king, he wrote it against Parliament. Because Parliament was bringing back the licensing of books. In other words, they had to be approved before they were printed, a sort of Leveson inquiry process. And Milton thought this was an outrage against free expression. But the other great point about Milton's defence of free speech, which is stirring and fantastic and inspirational, is that as for every champion of free speech through the ages, he had his limits. And for Milton, the limits was what we might call political Catholicism, in the same way that we now talk about political Islam or radical Islam. That essentially, Milton thought that if you, it wasn't a matter of being a Catholic, but if you were a Catholic who put your faith in the service of foreign powers who wanted to destroy English liberties, then you are not an equal player on the terrain of free speech. You were in the position of, in the 1950s and 60s, people would have thought this about the Soviet Union and about supporters of Soviet power. Now they were thinking about Islamic State and jihadists. And for Milton, there was this one crucial exemption to the principle that you had to have absolute freedom of speech and argument. And it was that if you were doing the bidding of the Catholic powers in trying to destroy English liberty, then you weren't playing by the same rules as everyone else.
You know, you talk about the sort of limits here. Are there things from Milton which effectively don't map on? I mean, you know, Milton's theodicy is very, very hard, surely, to reconcile to our worldview. I mean, the idea, as you say, that Eve's sin is a sort of virtue in as much as it's part of a providential scheme which turns out right in the end over thousands and thousands and thousands of years is one that's completely alien, surely, to most of our
Yeah. Second well, of course, the other point is this insistence at the outset that Eve has to be of inferior status. He for God alone, she for God in him. But however, once our Eve starts speaking, she undermines this so effectively that you do tend to sympathize with those critics who say that there is an official Milton who was promulgating a fairly orthodox theology, even if it was from quite a radical Protestant standpoint. And then there is the imaginative, the creative Milton, who always allowed the other point of view equal weight and sometimes perhaps superior weight.
That was Boyd Tonkin and Sam Leith. And you can also subscribe to our books podcast hosted by Sam, who this week talks to Michael Mopergo. On to our final topic, songbirds. In this week's issue, Simon Barnes writes about how British territory in Cyprus is at the centre of a cruel criminal industry towards songbirds. He joins me now along with Guy Shorrock from the RSPB. So Simon, what's going on?
It's an extraordinary situation. What is happening is that every autumn, according to long Cypriot tradition, they catch songbirds which come migrating through from Europe on their way down to Africa for the winter. It's the time of the biggest glut because the young ones are there with the parent birds all heading south together in a great mob. And throughout the centuries, birds have been caught and consumed. What's subsequently happened is that this has become an enormous industry. And last autumn, as many as 800,000 birds were caught in one single place, which is the best place on Cyprus for catching songbirds. That place happens to be a British base, British military base. And it is here that the songbirds are caught illegally and against everybody's will. It's a place that is therefore in control of criminals, in short.
And it's a British base, so are the British able to do anything about this?
That's right. The it came over to Britain when the Republic of Cyprus gained its independence in 1960. It's and on this place called Cape Pila is the heartland of the bird trapping business. What's happened is that they've planted avenues of acacia trees, which covered at one stage 150 acres, and you suspend mist netting up between the trees. Then you play blackcap song throughout the night at a major volume, and the migrating birds come dropping down from the skies seeking relief from the intensities of their journey. And there they're caught in the mist nets, and they've taken fluttering from these nests. Their necks are broken with a gentle bite, and then they're taken away to restaurants where they are sold illegally and then consumed illegally.
Guy, does this fit with what you've seen with your work at RSPB?
Yeah, I first went out to Cyprus in 2000 when we had information from expats living about there, the level of trapping. And as Simon says, this is a traditional activity, but traditionally it involved the use of lime sticks, which is basically a sticky twig. When the birds land on it, they can't get off. But all bird trapping has been illegal in Cyprus since 1974. However, when we got out there, we were astonished. There's nothing traditional about modern mist nets and MP3 players belting out birdsong. And as Simon said, it's become a criminal industry. Once we got involved, I was involved in organising the first survey of bird trapping levels back in 2002. And BirdLife Cyprus has carried on this amazing annual trapping survey every year, which gives us this amazing baseline data of levels of trapping. And again, the report's coming out tomorrow, again, very depressing. On the island as a whole, probably estimated around 2.3 million birds being caught. Now, levels are probably slightly down across Cyprus as a whole compared to back to 2002. But unfortunately, in the sovereign base area that Simon has mentioned, levels are up. And the politics of it is fascinating and very, very difficult because the demand for the birds comes from the restaurant trade, which is in the Republic. And a plate of dozen birds, known locally as Ambilobulia, might be worth 60 euros. And whilst there is lots of trapping in the Republic as well, this concentrated area is on this Cape Pila. And as I say, the MOD have been trying to remove the acacia, which this is the killing fields where these birds are caught. But unfortunately, despite some initial success in removing about 50 or 60 acres, when they've tried to do more work in 2016, there's been fairly significant protests from the pro-trapping community. And as a result, they've been simply unable to get the acacia effectively cleared. So it's a really difficult problem. We've got lack of political will in the Republic to deal with the restaurant trade. And we have a problem here on our own base areas where the MOD are struggling to get the acacia cleared.
Simon, is there any way that these could be produced sustainably, or is it just something that has to be stopped?
It is illegal under European law, and Cyprus is a member of the EU. It's true that island nations tend to seek a sort of pick and mix view of their obligations to the wider community, but that is the case. Cyprus is subject to the law, and the fact that the question of sustainability or unsustainability isn't really relevant. The fact is that in a scale like this, it is simply unsustainable in the way that fishing before regulations has been completely unsustainable and has fished out many great areas of the ocean.
And Guy, are we seeing an effect on the British bird population because of what's going on in Cyprus?
Well, most of the birds that migrate from Britain are going down a more western flyway. There are some species like lesser whitethoat, etc., which do have a more easterly migration. But most of the migrants are birds coming down from parts of Europe. And as I say, this whole issue of illegal hunting and trapping of birds all around the Mediterranean is a massive problem. A report that came out from BirdLife International in 2015, appropriately entitled The Killing, a scientific review there estimated 25 million birds being illegally shot or trapped around the Med. Whilst Egypt and Italy are probably the worst, Cyprus is up there in the top five. And interestingly, in terms of number of birds trapped per member of population, Cyprus is probably the highest. So there is a real concentration on Cyprus. And as Simon said, this is in breach of EU law. Interestingly, when I was out there initially, because Cyprus joined the EU in May 2004, prior to that time, when Cyprus was looking to join, we actually had quite a good response from the Cypriot authorities to things like the restaurant trade. But since they've joined, they've definitely taken the foot off the pedal. And certainly in the last couple of years, their enforcement action against the restaurant trade has been virtually non-existent. There is work being done by anti-poaching units, both on the base and in the Republic. And those anti-poaching units are very good. They're arresting lots of people. They're confiscating huge quantities of equipment. But of course, whilst the demand is there, during the autumn at, you know, 5 a.m, the trappers are just driving onto the base like people going to work. The whole thing is incredible.
That was Simon Barnes and Guy Shorrock. That's all for this week. You can subscribe to the podcast on the iTunes store or by visiting spectator.co.uk/podcast. And you can also subscribe to our other shows, including our US Politics Digest, Americano, and our religion podcast, Holy Smoke. And if you like the podcast, why not pick up the magazine? You can read all the features discussed, as well as great pieces by Simon Baron Cohen, Mary Wakefield and Martin Gayford. And we've got a trial offer. Get 12 issues for just £12 by visiting spectator.co.uk/12. Thanks for listening, and please do join us again next week.